do. And I think I've way too long, probably.
No, not way too long, but we should wrap up.
Okay, I'm done.
All right.
Soybean aphid colonizes glycine max, which is soybean. In the winter, it overwinters on buckthorn as an egg. Throughout the summer, the aphid is parthenogenic. It has females which reproduce only females. So they're able to increase in numbers very quickly. Each female nymph will become an adult and be able to produce within about 5 to 6 days. And they can produce anywhere from 0 to about 5 nymphs every day. The soybean aphid is able to transmit plants diseases. One of those diseases is the soybean mosaic virus. They are also responsible for a lot of plant damage, such as leaf deformations, stunting, lack of vigor, and if infestation occurs during the reproductive stages of the plant, reduced pod set can also occur.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm happy to be able to be here and talk a little bit about some of the work that we're doing with balsam woolly adelgid and the problems we're having with that insect in the southern Appalachians. The balsam woolly adelgid is a piercing-sucking insect specific to the genus Abies. It's native to the silver fir forests in Central Europe and was introduced into the southern Appalachians in the mid-1950s. This is the adult surrounded by her eggs. This is a crawler, which is the only motile stage, and the insect reproduces strictly through parthenogenesis. They are all female, and the dispersal is primarily through wind. They feed on the parenchyma cells in the phloem through their stylets. Tree responses for susceptible species include hypertrophy and hyperplasia of the parenchyma cells, which is expressed through scouting. Here you can see the buds, which is really quite hideous for a Christmas tree species. There's loss of apical dominance, disruption of phloem channels and metabolic pathways, and the most drastic symptom that it produces in Fraser fir particularly is this abnormal xylem, and it's called Rotholz, as it is quite red. This clogs up the vascular system, and the tree is essentially thrown into a state of physiological drought and succumbs fairly rapidly. Fir species vary in their susceptibility to the balsam woolly adelgid. Highly susceptible species include Fraser fir, shown here. European silver fir is much more tolerant here. And Vetch's fir, which is an Asian species, is just this side of immune. And we're focusing primarily on Fraser fir and Vetch fir at the opposite ends of the spectrum. Fraser fir is endemic to isolated high elevation populations in the southern Appalachians. This map shows the range of Fraser fir. There are 6 general areas. These dark areas are where we find Fraser fir currently in native stands, and these blue areas are where there should be Fraser fir and is not. So the populations are already shrinking. In the first wave of BWA-induced mortality, over 95% of mature Fraser fir were killed. It's also a very important Christmas tree species for the southern Appalachians, and the industry spends millions of dollars every year in combating the insect, and these pesticides minimize the effectiveness of IPM strategies. There's a collaborative effort at NC State among scientists in entomology, forestry, and wood and paper science looking at this problem and the effects of this insect. And our long-term objective is to develop BWA-resistant Fraser fir trees for both the Christmas tree industry and restoration in native stands. To this end, our short-term objectives are to develop an effective and efficient artificial infestation technique for screening for host resistance, and also develop methods for conducting laboratory bioassays. I'll talk first about this initial short-term goal. From the past, especially in the 1970s and 80s, when the insect was first really popping up throughout the country and people were doing a lot of research with it, the main method for infesting was to pin infested bark pieces to the stem or bole of the fir tree. So here's a sample there. It seemed somewhat unkind very early on, so I adopted very quickly a method of just tying the infested bark pieces to the tree. In preliminary studies using this technique, we were successful with infesting very young trees. Here is BWA egg mass on it was applied on a one-year-old tree. This is after some growth. You can see the gouting here, and these are the egg masses. This is a crown infestation of a three-year-old seedling. You can see the egg masses here. If I can find my... Oh, here. Okay. And these are the egg masses here on a six-year-old stem. We wanted to do a broader infestation technique study and to try and find some way of infesting the trees in a more time-efficient way. So we built a greenhouse in the mountains and put treatment plots in and installed a study with three treatments, two ages of Fraser fir, for a total of 240 treatment trees and 48 controls. And this essentially is the design within the greenhouse. So our techniques were to attach infested bark to the tree bole, simply place infested bark at the base of the tree, and then suspend an infested bolt over the entire plot. We did this a number of times. We just deluged the trees with insects. So the results, there was a difference between the two-year-old and the one-year-old, or two-year-old and seven-year-old trees, but the treatment differences with the younger trees was primarily in the very passive infestation of the controls. These were controls that were untreated in treatments one and two, which is attaching bark and placing the bark. And so this represents simply tree-to-tree infestation. With the older trees, however, 100% of the trees that were exposed to the adelgid with the attaching bark method and suspended bolt method were infested, and they were significantly different than the other two. The number of egg masses, there were very few egg masses in totality on the very young trees, but they're only this big, so you wouldn't expect there to be very many, and there was no difference among the treatments. With the older trees, however, there was a significant difference between the placing the bark and then attaching the bark or suspending the bolt. So we were comfortable with this bolt suspension method as being a very time-effective way to introduce adelgids to the trees. And we wondered, when we hang a bolt over, how many were falling, and is there any kind of a drift? And so I installed a little study in the back room of our lab with very little airflow, where I suspended a 4-foot bolt of Fraser fir over a grid. The grid is essentially, there are 192 little squares, 3-inch by 3-inch, on this grid, and took them off, subsampled them, counted them, estimated, and ran the data through SAS and came up with this contour plot. This is where the log is over, and you can see the number of adelgids. These are the numbers here that are represented, and so there are underneath the tree and in the surrounding areas thousands of crawlers that fall. So this is a very good method. We're comfortable enough with it to have used it for a much larger study using 740 trees in the greenhouse, smaller studies in temperature-controlled rooms, and then very small studies in lab incubators. And this last image leads me to the next objective, which is develop methods for conducting laboratory bioassays of BWA host interactions. So I used a method, adapted a method that was developed by our laboratory technician in keeping bark pieces hydrated with wet sand. I used that technique to stick cut branch tips in there, infested those with BWA, and I used Fraser and Vetch for five-year-old seedlings, and let it sit for 8 weeks. And we had first settled instars on all branches of both species, and on Fraser fir, On 10 of them, adults with eggs developed, and only one vetch developed, had any sort of development into an adult, which is what we would expect. And so I wondered what this technique would, how this technique would work with mature Fraser fir. And so I did that, cut branch tips from mature Fraser fir, and after 6 weeks, we had, again, first settled in stars on all branches and developing BWA on over half of the mature branch tips. So the implications from this are that this technique may be promising. We could use it for an initial range-wide host resistance screening within Fraser fir, for laboratory bioassays, and for maintaining also a source of BWA for predator diets. So in summary, this branch tip technique is promising. It is possible to infest even very young seedlings, and both the attaching bark and suspending infested bolts are effective techniques, particularly the latter, which is very efficient in terms of time and whole tree infestations. I'd like to thank quite a few people for funding and for help with these projects, and I'm open to questions.
We have time for a couple of questions.
Yes.
Leslie, I'm a student before you with Fred, and when I tried to infest Fraser fir seedlings, very small ones, I was successful, but the infestations were always very small, and then they would go away after the month.
Are you Hollingsworth?
Yes.
Yeah, your name should have been there. I'm really sorry about that. It was your pinning technique with the little wraparound. Now, say again, they went away after a while?
Yeah.
Right. Well, we've been able to maintain infestations for a couple of years, and it doesn't always happen that way, and it's difficult to say exactly why.
The significance of this species is that it's an invasive species originating from Asia. It was first discovered in Ontario, Canada, in Chatham, June 2001. The year that it was discovered, 2001, they had half the yield that they were expecting for that year, and the yield was 40. Was the lowest it had been in 47 years, excuse me. So the question I had was, is plant resistance to soybean aphid affected when soybean plants are transitioning through different growth phases? I picked four growth stages for this study. The first was the V2 stage, or first trifoliate. So this stage begins when the first trifoliate has fully developed leaves. You can tell by looking at where the arrow is pointing, right here. When these leaves on the next node, the edges are no longer touching each other, then this trifoliate here is fully developed. The R1 stage, beginning blue, this stage begins when there is a flower at any node on the plant. The next stage I chose was the R3 stage, or beginning seed. Here there is a pea pod where the arrow is, which must be 3/16 of an inch, and it must be on one of the four uppermost nodes with fully developed leaves. The R6 stage, or full seed, occurs when the pea pod is plump and full with the seed, and these pea pods must also be present on one of the four uppermost nodes with fully developed leaves. So my predictions, I had two. One was, if resistance is affected, this would take place at the beginning of the V2, R1, R3, and R6 stages of soybean development. Also, if resistance is affected, there would be a difference between the growth stages in terms of aphid fecundity. I had two fields for my setup. In J field, I had Harrow Vinton, which is a susceptible cultivar. I had two resistant cultivars in that field as well. One was Dowling with the RAG1 resistance gene, and the other one was background is Palmetto with the RAG1 resistance gene. Both of these varieties were developed by Vano Poisa and Elroy Kober from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. In S field, I also had Harrow Vinton as a susceptible cultivar. I had Dowling as a resistance with the RAG1 gene, and the Dowling was from Illinois University. There was also a resistance cultivar from Michigan State University in which the resistance has not yet been characterized. There's a slight error here. I actually had 50 cages or 50 aphids per plant variety, with 150 cages in each field. So in total, I had 1,200 cages. The start date for my experiment was June 25th, which was when the beginning of the V2 stage occurred, and my end date was September 17th, which I ended my experiments at Sinas. 4 days prior to the experiment, I took third to fourth instars and put them in nursery cages. I allowed those to produce offspring. It was the offspring from those aphids that were put into the field. The offspring were individually caged on the underside of trifoliate leaves. I monitored fecundity and mortality. Every other day when I went out into the field, I checked to see if the aphid was alive or dead, and I also recorded the number of nymphs that were born. Once the nymphs were recorded, they were removed from the cage. For the statistics, I conducted a three-way ANOVA. My factors were the field, either J field or S field, whether the plants were susceptible or resistant, and the plant life stages. Along the y-axis, I have the mean fecundity per day, plus or minus a standard error. On the x-axis, I have the soybean growth stages. So if you look at this bar right here, this represents the mean fecundity for all of the susceptible plants at the V2 stage. Where the asterisks are, those bars represent susceptible cultivars. And this was the mean fecundity for the susceptible cultivars was always higher than the mean fecundity for the resistant cultivars. Also, the mean fecundity was highest at the R6 stage for the susceptible plants and lowest at the R3 stage for the susceptible plants, with V2 and R1 being intermediate. For the resistant plants, the lowest mean fecundity occurred at the R3 stage of development, the highest fecundity occurred at the R6 and V2 stages of development, and R1 was intermediate. So to conclude, in each growth phase, fecundity was higher on susceptible plants than resistant plants. Also, there is a difference in soybean aphid fecundity to soybean aphid resistance between the soybean growth stages. Then I have my acknowledgments. Yes.
When you had the lowest growth rate for the lowest aphid growth rate, did you notice the difference when you address the aphid compared to when you have a higher growth
rate? The aphids all seem to appear very similar throughout the whole study. You mean aphids at different growth periods, right? I believe the question is if there was a change in the appearance of the aphids late in the season. And I do not believe that there was. When I did these experiments, they all appear to be similar. Yes?
Aphids tend to have a lower population growth rate when the temperatures are very high.
Yes.
What was the temperature of the beam like across this time period?
I have temperature data, but I have not yet put it into my analysis. So I cannot definitively say which growth phase would be the highest temperature or the lowest temperature. But in my opinion, just from looking at it, I would say that I think it was the R1 and R3 stages where the temperature was probably the highest.
And did you compare the two sources of resistance and see if there are any differences or similarities between these sources?
I did not compare resistant varieties to see if there was difference between resistance, so I cannot determine that. Any other questions?
Thank you. Hello everyone. Today I'm going to talk about resistance mechanism in our salad crop. Lettuce is one of the most important vegetable crop grown throughout the world in terms of consumption, production, and export. And it suffers great economic losses due to several insect pest feeding like leaf miner, banded cucumber beetle, cabbage looper, and beet armyworm. To manage these insect pests, growers have to depend highly on pesticide uses. So host plant resistance is an eco-friendly sound adjunct to the chemical control. A high level of resistance has been known in a romaine lettuce cultivar called Valmain compared to a closely related cultivar called Thalgozamain against leaf miner, banded cucumber beetle, cabbage looper, and beet armyworm. So here, as you can see, beet armyworm larva feeding is pretty much less on the resistant cultivar Valmain compared to a susceptible cultivar called Thalgozamain. So now we know Valmain has a resistance against four insect species: leaf miner, banded cucumber beetle, cabbage looper, and beet armyworm. So our next question is, what's the mechanism of resistance? Lettuce is a lettuciferous plant.
All right, thanks again everybody for coming. I am today going to give you sort of the thumbnail version of a conservation organization's approach to insect conservation, kind of what it's like to come sort of from the trenches of trying to do this work to actually protect habitat, to protect biodiversity on the ground, rather than, you know, spending so much time maybe more involved with the research side of things. So, and I'm going to experiment here with this, see if I can get this pointer to work. Look at that. So just so for those of you who don't know, the Xerces Society is an invertebrate conservation group. Our mission is to protect wildlife habitat and biodiversity by focusing on the habitat needs of insects and other invertebrates. We've been around about 36 years. We got our start working on butterfly conservation back, actually the year I was born, in 1971. And since the 1980s, have really expanded to embrace all invertebrates in our program work. And we work on pollinator conservation and endangered species.